teenagers sprout from cracks in the sidewalk like weeds, pliant, pushy. Merchants want sidewalks paved over and people without roots pulled out by their roots. Kittens, spikes, piercings, puppies. Merchants worry about tattoos. Does writing on bodies lead to writing on walls? Is there a clear and present danger of tattooed dragons burning their window displays? Can tattooed pirate ships sink merchant ships with their holds full of keychains and souvenir ashtrays? Teenagers wear leather jackets over a public disturbance of soft and warm. Teenagers wear chain necklaces bolted over smooth throats. Chain stores, locked out, locked in. Their skinny, damp palms sprawl, playing peekaboo with death and blocking the doorways. A girl with purple hair lost her belly button ring and wants the others to help her look. No one pays much attention. Night's coming and they're all out of cigarettes. They talk about clubs and bands, but it's just talk. If there were light, they might be lovely. If there were time, they might be young. For Mo, who died. I keep thinking it's an April Fool's trick, and Mo'll come back growling contemptuously over his cigar. You people believe anything. What do you mean, dead? I've still got a Mo's trade slip, Mo money, with his picture and the slogan, In God and Mo We Trust. I'll feel funny about using it now. I never minded George Washington being dead, but some people just aren't supposed to die. I remember Moe's voice loudly unharmonizing with whatever blues the ceiling was playing. She done him wrong, would drift upstairs and splash over the book I was browsing, hunched on a stool or poring through the rickety carts. I remember the continual cheerful grumble that came out of Mo like cigar smoke and, of course, the cigars. Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, but not now. I want all cigars to have Mo's face on the gilt band. I want Berkeley's no smoking ordinance to go up in cigar smoke at Mo's memorial. They can reinstate the silly thing afterwards if they have to. I want to plant cigars on Mo's grave instead of flowers and see what grows. Something will. I want exploding cigars. I want to watch the endangered whales blow waterspouts out of Mo's bald spot. I want every book at all four floors of Mo's bookstore to be about Mo, because I don't know much about him, and I never needed to before. He'd obviously always be there. I want Mo back. I recognize Mo's photo in the shop window. It's from the employee's bathroom, and it's one of a pair of photos in the same frame. The other photo shows Mo with his back to the camera facing the John, and I want that other photo to be in the shop window. I want to see Mo pissing all over that April Fool death that fools everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah?
I was thinking the guys that are going down there kicking butts live up in this rich community.
This is part
two of the
interview.
Yuppie kind of teenagers. Or whatever they... I didn't pay attention, you know. But I thought maybe they lived up there. That's why I thought I might let you know that, you know, came off up
sure.
there.
Yeah, I mean, that could be. But this
other guy, I was talking to him, and he said, well, that's the way they are in Watsonville. He said, down in Watsonville, they're gangbangers. And that's basically what this is, you know... A gangbanger is where like five or six guys jump on one guy, stood up, you know, one on one.
Did they look like they were Hispanic to you?
The one guy I looked at was white.
Right.
But I didn't look. I just tried to, you know,
get away.
Just say, well, you know, I'm not gonna stay around these guys long enough to have any problems. So I just turned around and walked back off. And this one guy kind of, I noticed he's walking right next to me. He's going, but I know some people here can kind of do mental telepathy. Think something to you and you understand it, but I don't receive.
Yeah.
You know, I thought maybe that's what he was doing. And I didn't pick up on it, so maybe that's what it was.
But you didn't say anything to them.
I didn't say a word. I headed down the hill.
Right.
I guess not fast enough. Maybe I should have just started running. But I think
that's the same thing.
I mean, you're reasonable. You know, your behavior was reasonable.
I was sleeping on the floor.
So hang on a second. So Mark, you say you're reluctant to report this to police and to make a big deal about it because if you get back in jail, you may witness what you saw a year ago. What did you see a year ago?
They put me in the jail and there was this guy sleeping on the floor and a guy standing by the door and he looked at the guy on the floor and walked over and urinated on him. And then when the guy woke up and looked at him, he kicked him in the head and started beating him up.
Did he say why he had done this?
No, there was no
reason?
Words, or just that action. And
this wasn't like 50 years ago, 5 years ago, but it was 1 year ago, right?
Just, yeah, maybe not exactly a whole year, but in that area somewhere. And
what were you in jail for at that time?
One of those stupid bike tickets, riding my bicycle without a light. And they took my bike into evidence and it had a light on it that worked, you know. But he said, well, I'm going to take you in anyway because this is my area.
Name of the officer who did that?
Oh, I don't know. Just a sheriff's deputy.
Thank you, Mark. Anything else you want to say?
That's it.
So it looks like conditions in the county jail, at least as of a year ago, were not too good for some folks. Mark was also, when he went to the Dominican hospital some hours later, when he got in there, they radioed the sheriffs to report this assault and have them come take a look at him, and the sheriffs, after 5 hours, had still not showed up. Not really terribly surprising. I've had my own concerns about how the sheriffs from the top, Sheriff Mark Tracy, all the way down to the bottom, have been treating homeless people in the county regarding, for example, the county camping ordinance. And I have been claiming that the county ordinance does not prohibit people from sleeping, but that sheriffs are misleading people about that. And we attempted to get a reading on that from Supervisor Marty Wormhout, who is the supervisor who covers the Santa Cruz area. And we've been really kind of trying to handle her with kid gloves. I've perhaps spoken of my concern about Marty Wormhout because a decade ago she was really engaged in abusive civil rights violations of homeless people as the mayor of Santa Cruz and as of the sort of key person at the city council at that time when she and John Laird sort of had this pseudo-progressive city council majority similar to the Rotkin-Kennedy majority of the last few years, and she initiated arrests of people at the town clock for serving soup, and then claimed, oh no, that it was the health department. She refused to set up alternate feeding services because she didn't like a flyer homeless activists had written. She took no action to stop a trial against Sandra Loringer for serving soup, and Sandy then served 3 weeks in jail, in the county jail, for I think it was giving out sandwiches, actually, and soup to homeless people at the town clock. There were literally dozens of people arrested. She had a homeless woman, Fran Rizzo, arrested for going to her house at 2 in the morning and asking for blankets for the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which she was unwilling to provide. She was incredibly outrageous. And finally, she voted against a safe place for people to sleep, the Sherry Connable proposal of 1990. That came up. A lot of other people also proposed it for the Coalition for a Safe Place to Sleep. So I was particularly incensed with her when she not only opposed the county camping ordinance, she opposed any kind of standing up for the rights of homeless people in the county. Because it seemed to me that at that time, the county camping ordinance has a roadside resting exception, which I've talked about in the past. That sleeping in so-called no camping zones in the county is barred, but elsewhere it is permitted. She brought to my attention an additional provision of the law, which I faxed today to the county council. That's the lawyer for the county who kind of gives out official legal interpretations to get his interpretation. She brought to my attention an additional section which bars motor homes, bars camping on roadways, roads, alleys, or rights of way, and also bars sleeping in a motor home on a public right of way. And this does rule out a lot more sleeping, but there really is a question as to whether a person in a vehicle that is not a motorhome can sleep at night and actually be illegal in the county. And many people have found that they can do this in a low-profile way, although they still get harassed, and you will be misinformed by the sheriffs about this. And the reason I know that it's really misinforming is because when we challenged them, they changed their story, and then they changed it back, and we still haven't gotten a clear story. They've said everything from you have to go to a campground to sleep to you can stay for 72 hours, but if someone complains, we'll roust you. In any case, I'm thinking the next focus of attention for those of us who want this issue of basic homeless civil rights to be brought to the public attention is the Board of Supervisors. They don't Wormhout is, she also has a Monday 5 o'clock meeting with anybody who wants to meet with her at the Java Junction. That'll be a week from tomorrow, it'll be a week from next Monday, because I assume she only has it on those times when there's a Board of Supervisors meeting the next day, as there usually is every Tuesday. Board of Supervisors meets every Tuesday usually, but not next Tuesday. And then she meets every Monday with anybody who wants to meet with her to talk about the agenda. So I'm going to be inviting people to join me to talk with her, and I guess we'll cover that topic more carefully as that date draws nearer. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, Civil Rights in Your Face, and hopefully in their face as well, because that's what apparently we're going to need to do. And with the students coming back from UCSC, I'm starting to make a few contacts again on campus, and old Just Man Jim Costner, who did a show from 1 to 3 today, is really interested in getting some protests back on the streets. We're talking about offering merchants downtown a sticker made by David Silva, which says, "Let the homeless and migrants sleep without fear of tickets or jail," and ask them to put these signs in their windows. And in the past, we've done this, and we've gotten these excuses, the owner isn't around, we don't know, we can't tell for sure. So my suggestion has been to simply offer them to merchants and say, offer them to people working there, say, show this to the owner. In a week, we're going to come back and see if the sign's in the window. If it is, we will encourage people to shop there. If it isn't, we will perhaps discourage people from shopping there, because it seems that human rights is not a priority for this store. And since human rights violations are a regular occurrence in this community, we want to give our money, give our support to those merchants who support basic human rights. I mean, it's pretty simple. And for those who are interested in joining this boycott campaign, or at least in sort of raising this issue, give a call to 423-4833, 423-HUFF. Or if you want to talk about it on air, we do have an open phone line at 427-3772 here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. That's 427-3772. Give us a call, and we'll do a little talking.
Come on, you argumentative sods who like to chew the rag, who'll stand in a bar for hours on end and a beardy talking jack. Sit down and park your feet a while, give your mouths a rest, and I'll tell you about a dame they call the Guardian of the West. Her hair was the best that money could buy, her eyes were china blue. I swear they wouldn't have looked out of place on a frozen cockatoo. She'd a nose like the blade of a metal saw, a voice like a tungsten drill. She used it to bore the natives when she had a couple of hours to kill. When she was a puking baby numb, she read in a magazine about the royals and decided then she'd like to be the queen. But the job had already been taken, so she stamped her foot and said, "If I can't be the Queen or the Prince of Wales, I'll be the PM instead." And so she moved from NW4 to a pad in Downing Street, a well-found joint where she and a bunch of dads beats used to meet. And they'd all dance round the table, then have a cozy chat, and in between she'd practice her elocution on the cat. The lady often said she'd like to have lived in the golden age, before the days of the unions and the national minimum wage. And she sighed when she thought how Hitler had smashed them all to hell. What he can do, I can do better, she said, and probably twice as well. And so she set out on the job of castrating the unions one by one. All except the ETU, and that had already been done. Teachers and civil servants, workers down the mine, needed a taste of the ladies' whip to make them toe the line. The printers, they came out on strike, and she went for them tooth and claw. Nurses and firemen struck as well, and she belted them with the law. They may be gallant heroes when they're saving people's lives, but they're just a bunch of layabouts when they're asking for a rise. Well, the lady's reputation plummeted down into the red, but trouble blew up in the Falklands. It was jam and a gingerbread. Thank God for a nice little war, she said, this is Britain's finest hour. So a couple of hundred swatties died so she could stay in power. The day a Polish shipyard became a casualty, she rushed to see Les Walesa crying solidarity. Oh, stay with us, my love, he said, but she answered with a frown. I've got to rush back to Glasgow, dear, to close a shipyard down. She doted on brave Colonel North and all that he represents, and she stuck like shit to a blanket to her favorite president. And she's madly keen on bushy tail of the dear old CIA, and she carried a torch for Botha and General Pinochet. Once behind the counter in her father's grocer's shop, she sold butter and jam and flour and spam and everything else the lot. But now the merchandise has changed, all prices don't apply. She's selling the nation off in lots to all who want to buy.
And that was Ewan McCall, The Naming of Names. Of course, he was talking about former Prime Minister Maggie Thatcher. And boy, I would like to have somebody do a song about Catherine Byers that's as good as that song. It's really important to have some strong political satire these days to keep us laughing as we get all wet and discouraged. Again, call-in number here is 427-3772. If you're not too discouraged to call in, or if you have something you want to talk about, we actually have an April 1st report, a special April 1st report from our foolish April 1st correspondent, and I'm going to put her on now.
Okay, this is the Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, April 1st, 1999 news report. Mike Rotkin announces he will lead the council to support decriminalization of sleeping for Santa Cruz's 500 to 1,500 homeless in safe zones. To sleep at night is a human right, Mike said. My socialist Marxist philosophy simply don't support one standard for the wealthy and another for the poor. Go Mike. Also on the council, Cynthia Matthews has announced today she was pulling the name of Dr. Bill Christie as a nominee for the Citizens Police Review Board. And instead, she's putting forth the name of attorney Kate Wells as her choice for the Citizens Police Review Board. Ms. Wells is a highly qualified candidate who will do a fine job of representing those who have suffered police abuse, quoted Cynthia Matthews. Newly appointed DA Ron Ruiz has announced he will reopen the Happy John Dine case. If that many eyewitnesses reported John Dine's hands were empty at the time of the shooting, there must be something wrong with the conclusion reached by former DA Art Danner. Speaking of Danner, in his new role as judge, he has announced he will find a verdict of not guilty for all sleeping ban tickets that cross his courtroom. My hands are tied by ICORN, he announced. Now, a downtown businessman, Kevin Four, who's the proprietor and owner of the Java House, announced he is allowing Robert Norris to re-enter his coffee shop. 4 years of banishment are enough, he said. I believe in forgiveness. Norris had been banned from the coffee shop for graffiti in the bathroom or flirting with minors. He can't remember which. It's been so long, I can't remember, said Kevin Four. Good news indeed. You should be cheered, Robert. Also, Police Chief Stephen Belcher apologized for an error he made last month. Whoops, he said. When I reported the statewide average of 2.1 police officers per 1,000 population, I accidentally transposed the digits. The correct ratio is 1.2 police per 1,000 population. Santa Cruz currently has a ratio of 1.7 police per 1,000 population, so we should all feel very safe. Mayor Byers announced she had lost sleep about her decision to leave the sleeping ban in place. I just can't live with myself, she said, so I am announcing a program to let the homeless sleep in peace. In Fresno! Any homeless person who wishes to sleep at night can get a one-way bus ticket to Fresno. Go, Mayor Byers. Scott Kennedy, former City Council member Scott Kennedy, in retirement, announces he is going on a hunger strike to end the sleeping ban. I could lose a few pounds, and I have the time, he said. Go, Scott, go. And this just in, the Prince of the Underworld, Mr. Satan himself, has reported an unusual cold snap. The whole place has frozen over, he said. This has been the Bathrobes Pierre Broadsides, April 1st, 1999 News Report. Thank you.
Whoa, and for all of you April fools out there who actually believe those reports, I have a number of bridges in various distant cities which I am prepared to offer you. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I actually been doing a lot of trying to get in touch with a guy named Arnold Abbott in Fort Lauderdale. I got in touch with Fort Lauderdale earlier this year around the issue of, well, in South Florida, some of you who have been following this show know, South Florida has decriminalized sleeping for homeless people because of the decisions of Clyde Atkins, a federal judge, back in 1992, in the famous Pottinger case. He ruled that you can't criminalize people, arrest them for life-sustaining functions unless there are places for them to do it where it is legal, such as to sleep or build a fire or cover up against the cold. And Fort Lauderdale, although not technically a part of that decision, apparently became concerned that it too would be sued for its criminal human rights abuses against the homeless. And they set up a tent city, which I guess stayed in place for about 5 years and only was recently dismantled. The tent city was apparently a successful tent city. There were critics both on the right and the left who didn't like it, but it was something that served homeless people during that period of time, at least some homeless people. And I know that Councilmember Rotkin, when he comes a week from today and has his debate with David Silva on the air, and that's not an April Fool's joke, folks, that's real, that's going to be happening, will be asked to confront those statistics, that there are cities like Fort Lauderdale that have had campgrounds, that have had safe sleeping zones, and the sky hasn't fallen in. Everybody didn't come to town. There wasn't a huge backing away from homeless people by social service agencies or charitable organizations or the population generally. Quite the contrary, the fact that homeless people were more visible meant that more resources was used because the community got downright embarrassed. And I guess that really is what we need here, is some serious embarrassment in Santa Cruz. But getting back to Fort Lauderdale, I ran across an organization called Love Thy Neighbor and a guy called Arnold Abbott, 70, I think he's 74, maybe he's 71, he's in his 70s. He's been feeding homeless people on the beaches since 1971, once a week, every Wednesday. He brings food down to the beaches. And he apparently was approached last week by the city, and they told him, if you do it anymore, we're going to have you arrested. And he was all prepared to fight this, but his own church and the religious groups that have been supporting him backed out and said that they wanted him to feed indoors far away from the beach, and that they would bus people from the beach to the church to eat. And I was really sad to report that he went along with this finally after fighting it for years. And the reason it's significant, you might say, well, why make it a big issue if your purpose is feeding people, why not feed them indoors? And the answer is there are lots of people who won't get into vans and go miles and miles to get something to eat. But they will take food if it's visible in a public place they can walk to, get it, and leave. And that's always been the case in city after city across the nation. And cities that want to cut back their homeless services and cut back homeless people being seen in public places sacrifice the well-being of homeless people and their ability to find good food by denying the right to serve in public places. And indeed, that's been an issue of controversy in cities like Santa Monica, where former city attorney Robert Myers resigned rather than write a law that would have criminalized feeding in the parks. He said it was an unconstitutional law and he wouldn't write it. And I guess the next city attorney wrote it, but it went up in smoke with a court decision. But most of the social services in Santa Monica stopped their feeding programs. It was only the few of the hardcore, determined, I think one group called Side by Side, and the woman who works for that, Jennifer Wagoner, also edits the homeless paper down there, Making Change, continued that feeding, and apparently still continues, and Food Not Bombs also continues to feed in public places where homeless people really are. This attempt to move homeless people out of the public eye was also tried in San Francisco in 1986-87 under Mayor Feinstein when she was mayor. And I guess Mother Teresa, who was serving food in San Francisco at that time, was persuaded to go move her operation to China Basin, which is a number of miles south of Civic Center Plaza, where most of the downtown homeless tend to gather, or many of them do. And Food Not Bombs moved in when Keith McHenry and other Food Not Bombers came to town in 1988 and sort of filled the vacuum, because people need places to eat, and the places that they have to eat really are public spaces where it can be seen, where it is accessible, where they should have a right to be. That was kind of an aside. I get lost in my asides. But getting back to Fort Lauderdale, I'm going to read from you this story that you can actually pick up from the internet, from the Love Thy Neighbor organization, which is the group that Arnold Abbott heads. And he talks about the situation of keeping safe zones even as the tent city closes down, because while we're still talking about letting homeless people sleep somewhere, this debate has been resolved. It was resolved in Fort Lauderdale in Miami like 5 years ago when they decided, essentially pushed there by a federal judge, they had to provide safe places to sleep if they were going to, for example, close their parks at night. They couldn't legally do it unless they had a safe place or a tent city, so they set up a tent city or safe zones in Miami. And then they closed the tent city when a homeless service center was built, even though the service center is only going to provide for a fraction of the people. And I guess this is the concern that Arnold Abbott had. I'm going to read you about this because this is really looking pretty far into the future. If and when they're actually if we get a campground set up and then they close down the campground because they claim to have some more homeless services, these are going to be the kinds of arguments you're going to be hearing in this more advanced discussion once we get to this point. Since 1992, Love Thy Neighbor has prepared from scratch and personally served more than 400,000 nutritionally balanced meals to Broward County's staggering homeless population gathered at Fort Lauderdale's only safe zone tent city, located on the block between City Hall and the Central Bus Terminal. In addition, we have organized and supplied prepared food and/or materials to cook with 16 other groups to feed when we are not there. We have distributed countless thousands of shoes, blankets, we presently have 900 on order, clothing items, and grooming aids. We have helped find scores of jobs, affordable housing, and even reunited 200 homeless people with family and friends all across the continental United States to begin their lives anew through our Homeward Bound programs. Today, there are about 6,000 men, women, and children living on the streets of Broward County. According to the Sun Sentinel, January 31st, 6,400 human beings. With the opening of the Homeless Assistance Center, which can facilitate a maximum of 200 people at a time for a 60-day stay, Tent City will be closed, dismantled, and its occupants dispersed to the streets without a safe zone. Both city and county officials, although asked repeatedly to provide a successor safe zone, have advised us that one is not needed since the Homeless Assistance Center will solve the problem of homelessness in our area. Homeless Assistance Center is a much-needed addition, but in the words of Ezra Krieg, its resource director, if anyone thinks that the Homeless Assistance Center will solve the problem of homelessness, they are sadly misinformed. Instead, the problem will be exacerbated. These folks, homeless because of a wide variety of circumstances, will have no place to go except to add hundreds to the streets of downtown Fort Lauderdale and its public buildings. To make matters worse, much worse, Mayor Nagel and Chief of Police Brassfield have announced a no-tolerance policy towards homelessness, stating that those not enrolled at the Homeless Assistance Center caught wandering or congregating will be arrested and thrown into jail. First off, Tent City, imperfect as it is, has been set up as a court-mandated safe zone, a place where the homeless can stay free from police harassment with a modicum of dignity in relative safety, and a place where health services and social workers can reach them. From there, they have a central location where industry-needing day workers can pick them up. Also, when cold weather strikes, it is a place where we can find our homeless friends and transport them to the Mills Center where they can spend the night indoors. Secondly, it is a place where Love Thy Neighbor can reach them in order to keep them strong, healthy, presentable until we can help as many as possible return to society as productive, tax-paying individuals. Now let's explore the possible consequences of not providing a new safe zone. This is where we draw a negative response or no response at all from the city and county officials we have contacted. We have appealed to them and explained as best we can that when you have fed individuals twice a day, 7 days a week, and then removed their support systems without a central place to reach them, you create a perfect setting for putting both the public and businesses in jeopardy. If Love Thy Neighbor has done only one thing for the homeless, we have instilled in them a sense of self-worth and simple dignity which would preclude their resorting to living out of garbage cans and dumpster diving, which is how they have survived in the past. They will not do that again, so how will they survive? The answer is frightening, but survive they will, and they will eat, even if it's by stealing, robbing, and grabbing purses. Without Love Thy Neighbor and the other groups that dare to love the unloved, they will do what desperate people do, and a period of lawlessness can result. It boggles the mind that those entrusted with protecting persons and property cannot understand the potential for a breakdown of law and order in Broward County, and particularly in Fort Lauderdale, where the majority of homeless are where they will stay, despite the hateful threats from individuals or from officials. We are not asking for money. We need the public to, one, show their concern for the homeless who are a cross-section of society down on their luck, and two, selfishly to indicate their desire to maintain the status quo, a continuation of peace and tranquility that has pervaded downtown Fort Lauderdale since Tent City was established 5 years ago. And then Arnold Abbott and his Love Thy Neighbor organization goes on to urge people to write the Board of Commissioners and the mayor. I myself wrote a letter to the mayor, as I think I mentioned on the last show, urging him not to arrest Arnold Abbott for serving homeless people food on the beach. But the significance here is, well, not only that a tent city works, and not only that tent cities accessible places for people to sleep and eat are essential, given the lack of affordable housing, the lack of shelter, the lack of places to be legally for homeless people. But you actually can see that there's sort of an advanced dialogue happening here. That and indeed, as I think I also mentioned in a previous show, other towns in Florida, I believe a Tampa city council member is calling for an open campground in addition to a homeless services center, which actually is just a kind of a fig leaf. It's only a small token gesture toward homeless people because you obviously cannot house thousands of people in a place where 200 can go. Here in Santa Cruz, for instance, you have 30 spaces on the floor of churches that will be available tomorrow night, indeed, that are available tonight. And that's just not going to do it for 500 to 1,500 people. And I guess I keep repeating this statistic for any odd, uninformed person who may have tuned in, who may not have heard about this, but there is a law that criminalizes sleep, criminalizes covering up with blankets, that criminalizes being if you're homeless in Santa Cruz. I also had a kind of a story I wanted to read to you about Arnold Abbott, and I was going to interview him and have you hear this interview with him, but it looks like he's really been forced to back off. I think I'm going to read this story anyway because I think it's a significant one, and I think we should remember the courage of people like Arnold Abbott. Feeding the Poor Nourishes His Spirit, March 29th. This is a story. This much we know. When the sun begins its set this Wednesday and most of us head home to kitchen tables laden with hot dinners, Arnold Abbott will pull his van up at Fort Lauderdale's beach and unload steaming casseroles and vegetable dishes. We know the hungry and the homeless will come here to sup, as they have every Wednesday for years now, and we know Abbott will provide, even as city officials ominously tell him to quit. What we don't know is whether something other than a hungry throng awaits him this week. A city park ranger warned Abbott and his volunteer feeding group, perhaps for the last time, that they're breaking zoning laws. The group Love Thy Neighbor has fed the homeless and working poor at this spot since 1991. Now, with a new homeless assistance center open, official types say Abbott's feedings are no longer needed, that he must stop or face possible arrest. "Don't do him like this," pleads Dennis Sharp, a Wednesday night regular who stands protectively behind Abbott as the park ranger delivers his edict. "He's just trying to help. He's what you call a soul provider. His voice calms the people." Abbott is not fazed by the hubbub. "I'll leave the beach after I've fed the people," the spry older man calmly tells the officers. After the police back off, Abbott, who is 74, ambles about the picnic area, calming everyone in low, dulcet tones. He soothes and gently pats backs. "Eat," he says, his voice a balm. "There will be no trouble. It's all right." As he moves from table to table, easing and allaying, it's as if his beloved wife, Maureen, gone to glory, hovers above him, whispers in his ear, "Do not be afraid," she might murmur. "Just remember, what would Jesus do?" It's as if the very essence of Maureen, known for feeding the homeless, urges him on, steadies his feet on the path they choose while she was still alive. Later, in a booth at Mom's Kitchen Restaurant, enjoying a mushroom and spinach omelet, Abbott pulls a photograph of his true love from his shirt pocket. He's still in love with Maureen, who died in 1991. "My angel called her Don... My angel called me Don... called me her Don Quixote. And so I must keep toiling at the windmill of injustice," he says, his spirit strong. City officials say the beach is not zoned for providing a social service, but the truth is that they just plain hate the homeless. And anyone who helps the homeless is a no-goodnik in their book. Born poor in Beverly, Massachusetts, Abbott says the family used to split an apple for dinner. His mother, claiming never to be hungry, always pushed her share to her son. From her, he inherited a love of humanity. "I was born knowing two things," he said, "that I am my brother's keeper and to love my neighbor as myself." And so he feeds. No one leaves his evening repast without first washing their hands at the spigot, then thanking Abbott for standing by, for providing. "Hey, Arnold, thanks, buddy," they say, filing by one after another. "I needed a good meal." Abbott clasps each hand, tells of churches and soup kitchens where a hot meal might be found until they meet again next Wednesday. "I will feed my friends," he says, resigned. "He'll just do his thing. The city will do its thing. I will do mine." And I imagine Abbott and his volunteers showing up this week with their hot dishes and warm breads, being met not with the threat of arrest, but by a host of pastors, ministers, rabbis, and everyday people willing to stand with him to help find the truth in the way. "They won't come," Abbott says, unable to hide his hurt. "They don't want to get involved. They don't want to anger their congregants. I suppose I embarrass them." Abbott sees revolution and its creative and liberating nature as an act of love. He stands alone, steadfast, beckoned by a higher power, and, of course, his beloved Maureen. That's Deborah Work's column from the Fort Lauderdale, I think it's called the Sun Sentinel. And, of course, the latest news was not good. Arnold Abbott, the retiree who feeds the homeless every Wednesday night on the beach, has had his last showdown with the city. Ministers from Christ Church United Methodist, where Abbott cooks hot meals for the homeless, told him Wednesday that he will have to move the dinner he has served every week for 7 years on the beach into the church, or he won't be allowed to use the kitchen. Abbott agreed to go along with the change. "Our purpose is to feed the homeless people. We don't like to create controversy," said Fred Scarborough, a lay pastor for the church and director of Shepherd's Way, which provides housing for the homeless. "He hates this change. He's big about it. His heart's in the right place." Abbott has been feeding the homeless on the beach since 1991, although it is illegal to provide an open-air social service on the beach. However, the city did not try to enforce the law until the new homeless assistance center opened and Tent City closed. The city sent Abbott several letters telling him to stop feeding people on the beach and threatened him with arrest. Abbott refused to stop, saying he and his corps of volunteers had a right to feed the homeless so they could eat on the beach like anyone else. And I might add, they were feeding a movie crew right next to him last week, according to the report we got. Tired of the fighting, Scarborough said, church vans would pick up homeless people at the beach and bring them to the church. "We aren't in for breaking the law," he said. "The church is committed to doing this until another site can be worked out. We want to defuse this situation and feed homeless people. Not only will we feed them, but we'll be offering clothing, housing, and counselors, pastors. This is not just going to be a feeding. Of course, it's also going to be a surrender, is what it is. You are essentially cutting back the number of people you are feeding. You're cutting off the support from a man who's done this for 7 years or however long he's been doing it. And you are essentially succumbing to the city's strategy of removing homeless people from public places. Now that they have their little homeless assistance center set up so they think they're free from legal challenge, they're going to attempt to enforce unconstitutional laws. And the best way to enforce them, of course, is to threaten social service agencies with this and that and get them to round up and herd up and pen up homeless people in areas where they can't be seen, in areas out of the way. And that's what Fort Lauderdale is doing.
When our towns were in flame and yet we got the blame, I wasn't surprised. When police stormed the streets and no one came to our needs,
Haven't played that tape in a while. It looks like the tape was taping a skipped record. Let's see, are we still skipping?
I killed even right in our church.
Nope, we're okay.
From too many cries.
Is there anybody here who'd like to change his clothes into a uniform? Is there anybody here who thinks they're only serving on a raging storm? Is there anybody here with glory in their eyes, loyal to the end, whose duty is to die? I want to see him, I want to wish him luck, I want to shake his hand, don't call his name, but a metal man. Is there anybody here who'd like to wrap the flag around an early grave? Is there anybody here who thinks they're standing tall around a battery? Is there anybody here who'd like to do his part, a soldier to the world and a hero to his heart? I want to see him, I want to wish him luck, I want to shake his hand, want to call his name, put a medal on the man. Is there anybody here proud of the parade, who'd like to give a cheer and show they're not afraid? I'd like to ask him what he's trying to defend. I'd like to ask him what he thinks he's gonna win. Is there Is there anybody here who wouldn't mind a murder by another name? Is there anybody here whose pride is on the line with the honor of the brave and the courage of the blind? I want to see him, I want to wish him luck, I want to shake his hand, gonna call his name with a medal of man.
And that was Phil Oakes, Is There Anybody Here? Which leads into our final interview with Dragi Ursovic. And I think I probably have pronounced that wrong, but I think he will correct me. Dragi was on last night. He's a Serbian, very much concerned about the bombing, NATO, U.S.-initiated bombing of the Serbian people in Yugoslavia. And we're going to hear his perspective on that. We haven't seen much in the way of the Resource Center for Nonviolence standing up. Scott Kennedy seems to have disappeared from the scene. The only person I've heard who has had a word to say about this series of international atrocities, and I'm not forgetting the atrocities by the Serbian government, by the Yugoslavian government there against Albanians and against other peoples. Not at all. I'm talking about the pointless exacerbation of the situation by U.S. bombing, which is apparently being met by complete silence here in Santa Cruz. There's just no outpouring. Nobody's at the town clock except for lonely Phil Bear of the Beach Flats freedom fighter. Let's hear from a man whose relatives are over there who wants to give you a view different from what the media is putting out.
Okay, we have on the line with us this evening Dragi Ursovich. Do I have that right, Dragi?
Actually, Urošević.
Urošević. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And Dragi, you're a Native American whose folks came over from Yugoslavia.
Correct.
And you've been paying close attention to events going on in Yugoslavia for the last week, probably for the last few years. You want to just sort of give us your overall view of what's happening over there?
Well, the overall view would have to back up with somewhat of a history of the Yugoslavia and the Serbian people. The Serbian people settled in that area in the early 1700s and became independent around 1180. In 1389, they were defeated by the Ottoman Empire, and in 1804,
That's okay. Take your time. I mean, you catch a few of the dates in the news stories, but, you know, it's probably news to most of us, you know, what really has been happening in Yugoslavia historically.
Yeah, well, and like I was saying, in 1804, Serbian nationalists seized Belgrade, and
they seized
the capital of Yugoslavia right now, which is Belgrade, or Belgrade.
And what was it called then?
I'm not sure. I think the name was the same, but I'm not sure.
Okay, so they seized Belgrade, go ahead. What happened then?
They installed Karađorđe as Prince of Serbia, but they weren't officially recognized until 1878. Mm-hmm. And then in 1913, they annexed Macedonia. And right after that, in 1914, a Serb nationalist assassinated the Austrian Archduke, which began World War I.
Let me get you to drop back 2 years, because I know Albania and the Albanian minority majority in Kosovo, is it Kosovo or Kosovo?
Kosovo.
Kosovo have a significant role to play here. Haven't they also been seeking to have a certain amount of autonomy in this situation for a while there?
Yes, they have, but it's gone so much back and forth historically on that the land itself, that's the Kosovo is where the Serbs settled back in the 700s.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been the center of the people, who they are. It's a very important land to them. They won their freedom there later on in history from the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And its nickname is sometimes called, I can't remember right offhand. There's a nickname that they gave the land because it has six monasteries that were built hundreds of years ago, Serbian Orthodox monasteries.
Mm-hmm. But in fact, in the last, 30 or 40 years, it's had an Albanian majority?
Yeah, what happened was at the end of World War II, there was in the area of Kosovo, there was both Albanians and Serbians, but at that time the Serbians were predominant, which it was about a 60-40 split at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And because the land was so bad in Albania, Marshal Tito had opened up the land of Kosovo for the people to come in, and opened up the arms of Yugoslavia to them to resettle them, give them land, and all of that.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of Albanians took up Marshal Tito on that offer, huh?
Yeah, they did. In World War II, part of that, to understand what I would think is a big-heartedness of Marshal Tito, was in World War II, the Serbians suffered a Holocaust of their own. Where there were 700,000, which is a very conservative estimate, 700,000 Serbs killed at the hands of pro-Nazi Nazi Croatians and the Muslims and the Albanians in the area.
Now, I know that the Yugoslavia itself has been a kind of a conglomerate of at least, numerous different lingual groups and numerous different religious groups, Greek Orthodox, Catholic.
Predominant ones are Serbian Orthodox, which is Serbian, Catholic, which is Croatian, and then the Bosnia Herzegovina is Muslim. And Macedonia would be, predominantly Serbian Orthodox.
And then you have, I guess, in Kosovo, you have now predominantly Muslim, right?
Correct. Muslims in when the Ottoman Empire overran the area and we lost the war to them. And back then, the Albanians and the Serbians fought together against the Turks. But when the Turks won, that's when the Albanians become Muslim.
They converted and the Serbs did not.
Correct.
Now, I understand that the Albanians have, since World War II, been struggling for a certain amount of autonomy in that region, which they were finally granted in the early 70s, but which was removed in 1989. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's accurate. In 1989 was the beginning of the Croatian and the Serbian conflict, and I believe in the Constitution of Yugoslavia, they're allowed the autonomy, but if wartime comes around, the president has a right to pull the autonomy back.
Didn't the actual fighting start in 1991 in Slovenia? That is to say, when Slovenia seceded from Yugoslavia?
Yeah, I think so, but I think that was...
Followed by Croatia.
Yeah, followed by Croatia. The Croatia one was the more predominant one because of what happened in World War II with the Serbs. The Croatians took the predominant fight against the Serbs. They were on the Nazi side of the war.
The Ustashi?
Yeah, the Ustashi, thank you. And it was so bad that even the Gestapo wrote a report telling Heimlich, what was his name?
Himmler.
Yeah, thank you, Heimlich Himmler, that the atrocities that were happening to the Serbians were incredibly devastating and beyond understanding.
So, from what I've read, and it's very limited, and I'm sure you can correct my historical gaps here, there were the actions taken by, I guess it was Milosevic who was in power in 1989, even prior, am I correct on that?
Yes.
Even prior to the beginnings of the war with Croatia and Slovenia, sort of reined in the Albanians, and that the Slovenians took fright from this, and that was one of the reasons they attempted to, or succeeded in seceding. Is that accurate?
Yes.
And let's sort of skip ahead now for a moment. We're looking at now at news stories. There's some debate in this country about whether the U.S. should be bombing the bejesus out of what remains of Yugoslavia, and for some of us believe this provokes further atrocities, if in fact these atrocity stories are accurate, by the Serbian authorities. Others feel that the Serbian authorities were going to do this anyway, and that there's a sort of an ethnic cleansing going on. Give me the big picture as you see it at the current time of... Are we getting an accurate description of facts in the headlines? What's the story?
For the studying that I've been doing and searching off the internet and different things and talking to people who have been through the war prior to this in Croatia, and even some people from the outside, Germans and different people like that who've come over from there since then, it seems that there's a very inaccurate picture being painted in the American press.
Mm-hmm.
Just recently was reading a story that had to do with... the massacre at the quote-unquote massacre at Račak.
Račak is a large city in Kosovo, or
correct? Correct. And supposedly there was 43 men shot and massacred and left off to the side of the town in a little gully. Well, what happened? What I found over the internet was different newspapers from France, Germany, and England have shown incredible amounts of proof that the bodies that they found there were moved to into place, and that all the evidence points against any kind of massacre. And that massacre was the beginning of what brought the world's attention to Kosovo.
Well, I, You've probably been watching the television news yourself.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of refugee stories of women crying, saying that, or being quoted as saying, I don't speak Albanian myself, but they're quoted as saying through translators that they saw their brother and their father shot, and if they didn't leave, they would have been shot, and then they saw their house burning from a distance. Do you credit these kinds of stories, or do you think they're inaccurate? Do you think they're accurate? What do you think?
I think it's wartime there right now to the Yugoslavian people. Once the bombing started, it was pretty much.
But why blame the Albanians in Kosovo for this, particularly the Albanians who are not carrying arms, women and children, men who are not specifically connected with the, you know, Albanian guerrilla movement?
Well,
I don't hold you responsible for this. I'm just asking you the question.
Oh, I understand. I don't know that they're holding them responsible, but what the Yugoslavian people, or the Serbian people rather, are seeing in a lot of this is that they're being attacked again, and historically they've been attacked over and over again, and no, we can't push history into the future, but at the same time you have an understanding of people who've been slaughtered over and over again. In the Turkish War, 50,000 were lost. In World War II, 10% of the population of Serbia was killed, with 700,000 of them being put to death by Croatians and the Albanians. With America coming in, bombing and backing this, backing the Albanians, it's a fearful time for the people there. They don't know what's going on. All the history over the past, since America has been founded, one of the first people to recognize America was the King of Serbia. And they've always aligned themselves with America in both world wars. In the Second World War, the Serbians are credited with...
Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead.
Are credited with bringing freedom to more American servicemen than any other country. There was 500 liberated in one time, and this is documented at the U.S. Air Force Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're confused. They don't understand why they're getting bombed and why now, even today, that the bombing is hitting inside the main city when America and NATO has talked so desperately about not involving innocent people. Now you're involving innocent people because there's no military stance in Belgrade. It's right next to apartment buildings that they're bombing for people who aren't even involved in the war.
The claim is they're bombing the defense ministry and other such public buildings, or...
Yeah, there's public buildings being bombed. I know that there was in Kosovo, there was actually one of the oldest monasteries was destroyed, and it was nowhere near what the fighting was, but it was destroyed. And it's a confusing time, I think, for the Serbians, because the people that they've allied themselves with and fought on the side of freedom through all the wars that America's been established in, they feel like they've been turned upon now, and they don't. Part of them, I guess, just doesn't want to take a chance with this when you hear so many things.
Well, aren't we talking about the governments? I mean, the government of Serbia and the government of the United States, run by rascals on both sides, is my impression. I mean, you have politicians who are, murdering Albanians and murdering Serbians, it looks like to me. In other words, I don't think the Serbian people have too much to say about what's going on. I mean, I don't see the Serbian people out on the streets killing Albanians. They're claiming that special military forces are being sent in to burn houses and drive Albanians out of Kosovo. And it's not the American people that are running over and killing, you know, Serbs. It's the U.S. Air Force under the command of the weenie-wagger Clinton, so to speak.
I would not argue that with you at all. I think there's a very vast amount of truth to what you said. But I would add the one thing that once the people, we may not like Milosevic, the Serbians, in all that he's done, but once the Americans started bombing, you have a national depth and pride that I don't think America really understands the history that goes behind these people, and they remember their history. And it was only 40 years ago that again this massacre of Serbians happened, 50 years ago rather, and there's a depth there and a strength and a pride behind Serbian people. When something like this happens, they're going to draw together. They will not go to their strong people. In fact, in that region, they were the only people to fight the Germans off without anybody's help. They pushed the Germans out and refused any help from America or Russia.
Well, it has been said that the 1/4 of the population of Kosovo, the Albanian population, has been reduced to refugee status. Most of that before the bombing started. I guess 90,000 has been the claim in the last week that has been created, not so much by the bombing, but perhaps by the response of Serbian military and paramilitary forces to the bombing.
I wonder how much of that is bad and how much of that is because the Americans are starting to bomb. I say that because the American press talked about genocide and the atrocities happened even before the bombing started happening, but you didn't see an exit happening so greatly as it is once the bombing began. You can time it right down to when the bombing began, that the exodus in all directions started happening.
Now, of course, the question is it an exodus from areas of the bombing, or is it an exodus from areas where Serbian security forces are allegedly taking atrocity-type actions, or is it both? Perhaps it's both.
That's pretty unclear to anybody right now, to be honest with you, because of the closed down by everybody.
Now, are you in touch with people in Yugoslavia and Serbia?
Yes, I have family that's literally within bombing range.
And I guess you can't reach them by phone?
Yeah, we can, on occasion. It's hard to get through, but we've been getting through.
And are these folks Milosevic supporters? Am I pronouncing them properly?
Milosevic? I haven't really talked to him about Milosevic. As I've talked to him, it's been more on the lines of...
Are you well? Have you been bombed lately?
Yes, yeah. The bombings that happened on the outskirts, I have family in Belgrade. The bombings that happened on the outskirts were within 5...
And that was... Drogi Urošević talking to me last night on the Serbian situation. A lot of the points we didn't get to make, this was part of a longer interview, concerned issues like why is the U.S. suddenly bombing in this situation when 500 times as many refugees and deaths were created, or at least deaths in Rwanda several years ago. The U.S. did nothing whatsoever. Does it help? Does this bombing actually have a positive impact, or does it exacerbate the situation? A lot of questions that to be answered here, and I'm wondering where the peace activists are on this question. I have to go. Bathroom Spears Broadsides is over. I'll be back on Sunday at 11 o'clock in the morning. I go for 2.5 hours then. I invite you to return. If you have any reports from homeless people in Serbia, all you Serbs out there and all you Albanian correspondents, let me hear what's going on. In the meantime, try to stay warm. And if you see someone sitting on the sidewalk getting a ticket from a police officer, well, sit down next to him. If you have anything you want to report to me on the interim, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Thanks for being with me, and tune in for the next edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides and the following show, which is known as Earth First.
And you're tuned to 96.3 FM Free Radio, and I want to thank Robert for another great show, Bathroom Spears Broadsides, every Thursday night at 6 o'clock and every Sunday night at Sunday morning at 11:30. 11 o'clock? 11 o'clock? Not covered up the schedule here, so of course I can't tell you what time.
It comes on next week at 6:30 on the show.
All right, so stay tuned next week for more stuff. Bye, Robert. And, of course, it's time for Earth First Radio. And let me get my my equipment set up here, and we'll be right back. Listening to Earth First Radio, I'm Uncle Dennis. Stay tuned for No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music.
You're cutting chainsaws, killing the trees, something, everything that lives in peace. Our animal friends are on the run, but there's nowhere to go when the job is done.
this all takes place. We've got to stop this inhuman race.
And it's time for Earth First Radio. All right. Still sorting stuff out here. Welcome to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. Every week I bring you no compromise news, views, poetry, and music for activists on the front lines of the environmental movement. In today's headlines, we're going to have more information about the Forest Guardians bombing. We'll hear about what's happening in Iceland and why the Sea Shepherd Society is interested in it. We'll move over into news from Washington, D.C., and we'll head up to our national forest to find out about roadless areas. We'll have some... And that should just about do it for today. In these stories, you'll hear today about folks who are killing the planet and folks who have detailed information about saving what's left. They all have names, addresses, telephone numbers, fax numbers, email, and web addresses. So go get a pencil or a pen and some recycled paper to write down the information, because it's going to be a test later. This isn't Couch Potato Radio, it's Activist Radio, and I urge you to take down this information and act on it. You really can make a difference by writing letters, sending faxes, and making phone calls. When you aren't out in the woods or up in a tripod or a tree sit or locked down at the road blockade, of course, Earth First Radio can use your help. If you have announcements or news about what's going on in your bioregion, send it by email to cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. You can send regular mail to Earth First Radio at Post Office Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance, because, you know, Uncle Dennis has just got to keep his act together, and that's the only way I can do it is if you help out, okay? Let's get right on into activist news here. In a letter, news from Arizona, or New Mexico. Officials of an environmental protection group believe that a little-known radical group is responsible for the attempted bombing last week at their offices in Santa Fe. The Forest Guardians, a nonprofit group devoted to preserving forests and other environmental issues, received a drawing in its mail at its offices last Wednesday morning, signed MM, said Sam Height, president of the Forest Guardians Board of Directors. It appears to be the same group that alleged responsibility for shooting up the offices of an animal rights organization in Santa Fe in December, Mitt added. The bombing attempt and the drawing appear to be in retaliation for his group's efforts to protect forests and to support the reintroduction of wolves into the wild of New Mexico and Arizona, Height said. The State Department of Public Safety has tentatively identified MM as the Minutemen, but has no information about the group or individuals in local, state, or federal criminal databases, according to Robert Vanderhee, a department special investigator. This guy or group is dangerous, Vanderheeter said. The envelope containing the drawing is stamped with an Albuquerque postmark dated a week ago Saturday, one day after a Forest Guardians worker discovered a pipe bomb in the group's mailbox on 2nd Street. Santa Fe Police Department bomb squad detonated the bomb on Friday, but no one was injured. The drawing is of a rifle scope's crosshairs over the words Forest Guardians. It includes the phrase, MM was here. The drawing is similar to one Animal Protection of New Mexico Incorporated, a statewide organization devoted to animal rights, received several days after the group's offices were riddled with shotgun blasts last December. Lisa Jennings, the group's executive director, said Forest Guardians officials showed her the drawing they had received, and she was sure it was made by the same person who sent her a drawing after the attack on her group's offices. The two groups were targeted because they are involved in protecting wildlife and preserving public land, she said. I think these are really dangerous people, Jennings said of the group or individual who attacked her office. Nobody was at the offices of Animal Protection of New Mexico, Inc. at the time, and nobody was injured. Height said that he told the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms about the Santa and the Santa Fe Police, which are investigating the attempted bombing, about the drawing. So far, no suspects have been identified in the bombing attempt, George Dahl, an ATF resident agent, said last Wednesday. Forest Guardians, in its 10th year, has received other threats over the past years, but none has been as violent as the bombing attempt, Height said. But threats will not stop the Forest Guardians. We're pressing forward with litigation that enforces environmental laws. That's good news from New Mexico. And let's move up to Iceland from Reykjavik. Iceland's parliament has voted to start whaling again. The resolution passed March 10th means the country is ending its 10-year ban on whaling. The government is preparing for a resumption as soon as possible. The parliamentary motion was passed with 37 votes in favor and only 7 against. Quote, as representatives of a democratic nation, the Icelandic government must now act on the will of parliament and allow whaling to resume this summer, said Sveinn Godmundsson, information officer of the High North Alliance, representing whalers, sealers, and fishermen from Canada, the Faroe Islands, Greenland, Iceland, and Norway, based in the Lofoten Islands of Norway. Iceland's action has drawn the attention of Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, a group based in Santa Monica, California, that has pledged to protect